Folks, hello and welcome to This Wreckage. Still getting used to the new name. I am here. I am honored to be here with, I'd say, a new light, a new luminary on the scene. Don't call him Left Hoop. Certainly don't do that because that has a whole connotation to it. But I am here with Tony of One Dime Radio. Tony has both a channel where he does long form video stuff. Again, not to be confused with Left Tube, and also One Dime Radio, where he interviews such great people as our friend C. Derek Varn, whose recommendation allowed Tony to agree to come on to the show today. So, Tony of One Dime, welcome to This Wreckage. How's it going?
I'm doing pretty well. How about you?
Oh, I'm hanging in, man. It's been, I had a week off from work, which was nice. You ever get a week off from work before?
Yeah. Back when I did 9 to 5. I don't do that anymore, luckily. Thank you.
Oh. Do you do this professionally now?
Yeah. I do side work as well, like, you know, finding it extra, but it's really, this is the main thing now.
That is awesome, man. That's a good lifestyle. I only really live that life
more now though. That's weird.
You work more now, but you work for One Dime. You work for Tony. You work for yourself.
Yeah, because there's no like off button. That's the annoying thing.
There's no clocking out.
Yeah.
As it were. Yeah. People who are listeners of this show will know that I got shit canned. I got fired last Friday. Not this Friday, but the Friday before that. And it was fucking awesome. I went out with a blaze of glory. I told the management to go fuck their ass and they fired me. It was great. but unfortunately, all good things must end. And I do have to start a new job tomorrow morning. I don't have to, but I really should. So I am going to be starting that. So when you ask me how I'm doing, you know, I'm always, you know, you always kind of got to like gear up to start a new job. You know, it's probably been a while for you since you started a new job, but you kind of got to get in the right headspace. You have to like calm yourself and tell yourself everything's going to be fine. It's going to be good people. I'm going to work with the best and blah, blah, blah. So that's kind of the headspace I'm at right now.
Yeah, you have to like de-autismify yourself too. Like, I don't know, watch like Friends or something to be normal.
Right, to get like some view into the social reality out there that isn't the four walls of your fucking apartment.
What industry? I'm just out of curiosity, because for me it was like a lot of white collar, so it's like a particular kind of like I relate a lot to The Office or movies like Office Space, stuff like that, obviously, right?
Yeah, I think if I was preparing for that kind of work, it'd be more like putting a firearm into my mouth and pulling the trigger, because I can't do that shit. I don't work in the white collar world. I'm in heavy highway and marine construction. So
nice. Actual job.
I guess like value producing job.
Hell yeah, dude. Pays proletarian and former PMC, or technically, I guess, I don't know, what am I now? Petit bourgeois. I own my production.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But then like the rest of the petit bourgeois, I don't actually own it. It's YouTube who owns it. I just get the scraps.
Isn't that like SaaS or something? Like business service as a some shit like that.
Self-employed, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know what, dude? Like
self-proprietorship, yeah.
The petty bourgeois label comes for us all at some point in time. I think that there's like whole elements of the building trades that like aspire to petty bourgeois. Certainly like once you get into the layer of like bureaucratic layer, it is petty bourgeois. But
really, you think so? I actually think they're very different. I think like the PMC and the petit bourgeois are like completely different.
So we're getting into it now. We're fucking getting into it now. Tell me more. This is Tony, you're our guest, and you said earlier like I don't want a windbag on the show. Dude, just windbag out. What do you think theologically is the difference here? Because I'm interested. I'm honestly interested. If I can just kind of foreground and then I'll kick it to you. This discussion is, you have two things going for you, which I don't. The first is that you're young, and the second is that you're Canadian. And so I'm here to listen and learn from a Canadian. You're going to tell me sociology. You're going to explain to me what Canadian politics and Canadian life looks like.
Oh, God, no. No one cares about Canada. Dude, whenever I cover Canada, I get a quarter of the amount of views I usually do. It's just, it's pathetic.
That is pathetic, but for your fucking listeners, it's pathetic that they don't give a shit. Like, I think I care. I you might have to convince me why I care, but I think I do care. So you're going to come on. The only people I know who are like in their 20s these days are like building trades apprentices, and I don't think they're very...
Soon I'll not be in my 20s, but yeah.
Okay.
I'll enjoy them while they last, but yeah.
You are considerably younger than me, so you have a different series of events that, you know, have happened to you, maybe a different idea of the world that you grew up with, a different structure of feeling, let's say, growing up in the time that you did. I was 21 when 9/11 happened, for example. So we'll do all that. But first, talk to me about the PMC and the petty bourgeoisie. What are your theories?
Yeah, we don't have to get into it too much, but I mean, the PMC is really a sociological category. Some debate as to whether it's like a class in a Marxist sense, but to me, I don't like whether it's class in a Marxist sense. Doesn't really matter. It's like, does it explain reality? Theory to me is utterly useless if it doesn't explain reality. Hmm. And if you look at like how people in white collar vote versus people who are small business owners or people who are blue collar workers vote, it's just so different. And I think it's because people in the PMC are usually people who go to university and they come in with an expectation of getting a job where they don't have to do manual labor. That's like often why they, you know, go to college, go to university and study all this shit. So for me in Canada, that was the government. In Canada, the government is like a huge employer. They create a ton of bureaucracy. It's the embodiment of David Graeber's polemic, except, you know, he talks about the private sector too. The PMC is like actually closer to a worker on paper in the sense that they don't necessarily own capital. They might have a 401k, but they are, you know, for one, the professional that signifies the sort of white collar component, and managerial, in that they usually aspire to move up the hierarchy. They usually aspire to be a manager. And when you're a manager, while you might not own capital, you have a very different relationship to power than like a person who is being managed, right? And a lot of times it's not without reason that we usually hate our managers more than we hate like the owner of the whole company, because that's who we experience.
They're on the front lines, exactly.
Yeah.
I tell you an interesting thing that I was thinking about. This was last summer. I'm trying to think about the job. Two summers ago, we had a new supervisor. This big company that we were working for brought a new supervisor, like a younger kid onto the job. And like we weren't cruel to him, but like we told him basically that we run the work. You know, it's our skills that makes this shit go. It's our labor that makes this shit go. His sole job was to facilitate us producing, doing production. And it took a while to kind of break him into that mold. And I was thinking about it at this time that like management is this very interesting layer. Where like if the proletariat, if workers played their cards right, they could actually make management subordinated to their own interests, right? But that's very, very difficult, obviously, because their paycheck comes from a boss. But like the management layer, it's maybe confusing to put them alongside like doctors or lawyers or other professionals.
Right.
I think that, you know, Derek Varn, I always outsource all my theory and thoughts and class to him, as most of us should be doing. He's been very critical of the PMC as a Marxist category. But like you said, and I think I fundamentally agree, as a sociological characterization or classification, it makes some sense. It explains things about the real world, about the social world, about class composition that I think is useful. So maybe you and I agree on that front. Yeah. The original question was, what is a labor bureaucrat? You know, what is like a person? It used to be people would rise from the rank and file into union management, and they would come to represent, you know, or come to embody certain sort of inertia, momentum within the workers' movement that could be moved in the direction of socialism, as it often was even in the United States in the 19th and early 20th century, or increasingly These rank and file into management workers, managers ended up, of course, becoming kind of petty bureaucrats themselves and whatever opportunists, let's call them, or an aristocracy of labor. But like now, more and more.
Yeah, I don't even think of it like aristocracy of labor.
I mean, maybe that's what we mean when we talk about that. I'm not sure.
Nah, because that's why I don't view it all as like class, like in the sense of the Marxist sense of like who's wealthier. Because it's like if you look at like income, there were people who are wealthier who voted for Zoran Mamdani, but people who were less wealthy and didn't have college degrees who didn't vote for him. So it's like a lot of it, it's, you know, sociology, I think, like explains a lot of this stuff sometimes more because it's so socialization. Like you might have more or less income, but you might have it's a different habitat. Like there is still a labor aristocracy. I would say like people who work for Microsoft and like, you know, like big tech, these sort of very high paying professional jobs, I would say definitely. And now one of my friends took me to is the Amazon location in Vancouver where he works. And it's just incredible. It's like a university. I'm thinking like you work here. This is like, it just looks incredible. They have basketball courts, saunas,
perks. They got snacks. They got beers. I'm assuming they've got all that good stuff there.
Yeah. Oh yeah. They got all that. But with the education divide, I think that's what we're talking about. Like the PMC mentality, PMC, you know, for one, because it's more like quote unquote intellectual labor. A lot of the people learn to be more politically correct. They are more self-censoring, whereas in jobs like construction, it doesn't really matter what you think. It's what you like just do, but not what you say. So it's like very, and I saw this disconnect just due to like some of my closest friends. One in particular never went to college. And, the disconnect was always clear between my university friends and him. And, you know, it's like there's this that you're just not socialized to worry about, like, what is the latest pronoun? What is the latest whatever? And when we think about how the left is out of touch, the problem with the PMC left, Catherine Liu talks about this, many people do. It's not so much that they're like tied to the ruling class or are exploiting the underclasses. Is that they are just literally out of touch because they are socialized in such a completely different environment. You know, and hence why they'll say stuff like they'll call you a class reductionist for focusing on basic bread and butter economics. And they'll say every time you suggest that, they'll be like, well, what do you want to throw this minority group under the bus?
Right.
Or, you know, they'll be a really hyper obsessed with cultural issues that most people don't give a crap about, but probably wouldn't give a crap about even to oppose, but they wouldn't care in the first place if they didn't talk about it so much.
Yeah, Tony, this is fascinating that we got here this early, because this is a
hit my toes around it there. I was like, I'm so tempted to take it to a certain place. I'm like, no,
you took it to a place that I think is very comfortable for us, comfortable having this sort of debate that spanned the last, I'd say, more than 10 years, probably 15 years, but really ratcheted itself up in 2015. You know,
Bernie
Sanders. Yes,
right. Yeah.
These questions of class versus race or whatever. You know, I wonder now because you know, the listeners out there have heard me and Andy and other people talk about this for a long time. Personally, like, I think it's very interesting how we talk about this, but I'm kind of like over the debate itself. And what I wonder for you is like, is there a way in which younger people are moving past this debate, do you feel like, from the folks that you talk to? Is this divide that you're pointing to between your friend who didn't go to college and your college educated friend, is that still generalizable? Is that still something that we need to fret about? And like, what have things changed on the ground? Because I'd like to think, And the only reason I've moved past this is because I am part of an organization now called the ILC, which is trying to move past these things in practice. But like, do you think that people are moving past this, or do you think these are the sort of questions that are going to continue to bedevil us?
There's a lot of questions there, but yeah. With, you know, there were this like class debate, identity politics. I know what you're talking about. Like, you know, that's why when people hear this, some people will say, oh, this is so 2016. Yeah, but except I don't think we learned the right lessons. Clearly, Bernie Sanders did not, given how he campaigned. He actually thought it was the opposite problem, that he was too class reductionist. And that's, they got it in his head that, you know, that's why he lost California to Hillary. So he did all he could to win California, but then lost all those swing states and the red states that he had previously won in 2016. But in any case, what is, you know, this? Okay, so like a lot of people, 2016 was the moment I got into radical politics. I already considered myself a socialist before that, but socialist in a very like social democratic sense. You know, it was largely due to the fact that, you know, the party I generally preferred, I hated the way their leadership was going, was the New Democrat Party in Canada, which is, you know, the NDP, it's social democratic adjacent. And they would often get like smeared as socialists all the time because they used to be. They actually used to be genuinely socialist. So I would just, for me, that label carried no stigma. I was like, sure, whatever. I liked Bernie Sanders in 2016, like a lot of people. When he you know, got screwed by the Democratic Party, I think like a lot of people, a lot of people tune out of politics. I tuned out of politics, but not out of like political, you know, like political matters. I just tuned out of the news cycle. So when everyone was like, I remember everyone was like paying attention to the latest thing Trump did, I just could not care. I tuned out as soon as Bernie lost, as soon as it was Hillary versus Trump. Like I just would tune in for the memes sometimes. I went into history and theory. So like that's kind of how I developed what I end up doing now and why like my main channel is largely history videos, economics, because that's really what I became obsessed about. It was like, okay, you know, the constant thing that was attacked about Bernie was like socialist, right? You know, that he's like somehow so radical and unrealistic. So I was like, what's the history of this thing? So really for the past, like at this point, yeah, I guess almost 10 years now, it set me on a sort of trajectory of just learning about all of this. And yeah, I didn't find, you know, There was all this threat about like fascism. There was this threat about this and that. And I did take a genuine interest in it, but, and that's what I did my bachelor's dissertation on literally like a couple years after that, was on the far right.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So, and then my master's was on something completely different, but, the bachelor's was on the far right actually.
Interesting.
And, I remember that's how I actually got into the Frankfurt School, because I was learning about Steve Bannon and Andrew Breitbart, and they were talking about this theory of cultural Marxism. And I'm like, interesting. So I looked into it, and that kind of led me to Marx. And I'm thinking, it led me to two things. One, there's nothing to do with the current left and Marx or Marxism or even like old social democracy. There's just nothing really there. Bernie has had that element, right? He had an element of that. I would call him the last new leftist in some ways. Because I wouldn't say he's an old leftist. He's a last new leftist. And what we have today is something else. It's neo-leftism. But we can get into that.
We could get into that. Maybe we should get into that.
It's related to what you sent me earlier.
Yeah. I sent you earlier. Let's go ahead and discuss it. Or at least touch upon it.
Yeah, I just want to answer your question, though, with those debates as to whether we're over it and stuff.
Yeah.
Because it's like, I think a lot of people have learned the lesson about class and like wokeness or whatever, kind of in the sense that they know it doesn't work. Like AOC dropped the pronouns. Zoran Mamdani ran a somewhat quite successful campaign in New York City, I should preface, but like still a very successful campaign where he really avoided being super annoying, like how a lot of these types are. He was very likable. He stuck to the issues. He kind of appeased everybody successfully in a way that's quite difficult for the left and liberals. That said, I don't think we really learned the lessons as to why, you know, like these sort of divides happen. Like when it talks about class versus race, it's already misleading, because for like working class people who are racial minorities, it's not, like that's not a really meaningful distinction, like in the sense that anything that would address class issues would address racial issues. Obviously it's a larger education divide, urban-rural divide? And why are people shifting, you know, rightwards? It's the left still thinks it's just because the Democratic Party sucks. What they don't want to look at is like the left also sucks. And that's why the left also votes for the Democratic Party all the time, because they identify with it. And yeah. Even if they say they don't, they say they don't, right? They don't want to vote with for it. But at the end of the day, what do leftists want to do? I know, like, I'm not really, you know, I assume your audience is a little different because of, you know, you talk to Varn, and so this stuff won't be that new. To some people, I went on Michael Burns' show, and God, did I piss people off by saying this?
I don't know who Michael Burns is, but it sounds like you read the comments in the comments.
Yeah, Michael Burns is cool, but the comment section was not.
Not cool.
Yeah, but the, okay, so a lot of leftists have this idea that it's going to take over the Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, it's either you take over the Democrats or you have this idea of like, oh, let's never participate in electoral politics. Okay. Why don't you run on the Republicans? Because I've been saying for a while that, you know, the DSA should run candidates in the Democrat and Republican Party. It shouldn't fixate only on electoralism, but in places where there's gerrymandered districts and the only options is primarying an established Republican candidate, you should do that. And historically, the parties have shifted roles, and the parties actually aren't that different, which is all the more reason, you know, to do that. So it's like, why is that unthinkable? But the Democrats, it's like you stick with them every time. It has nothing to do with the Democrats being more economically left.
No,
I don't think that it's the social component.
It is.
And that's where the big divides are. So on one end, I do think like the culture war is a distraction. That was my position before. Mm. But I've increasingly shifted in the past years to realize the culture war is directly tied to the class war, actually.
Mm.
And some of the issues people deeply care about isn't just merely because they're like propagandized. Like, for example, immigration. The more I looked at the European situation, the more I realized, okay, no, this is like, we need to have a conversation about this, because it's like, if the left just thinks that the only reason the left, like, people care about this is just because there's just really still very patronizing sort of like view leftists have of this people who aren't leftists, which is that like the only reason people care about issues that they don't care about is because they're brainwashed. And if only like they had got some, like, you had wealth redistribution, they wouldn't care.
There's, This is all very interesting, and I want to connect this back to what you were talking about with Bernie Sanders being like the last new leftist. There's this sense, and this is where I think it's very useful for us to maybe compare our experiences. There's a sense in which I believed something for a long time, which I don't believe anymore, but up until, you know, some years ago, I believed, which is a line that you'll hear from Noam Chomsky, or it's a line that you, if you read the literature on neoliberalism and deindustrialization, if you read the sort of heroic stories of the winning of the New Deal, for example, like the working class getting behind this grand project of you know, state management, state regulation, state control, state a popular front against fascism, but also a popular front against communism, right? In a way. What I'm trying to say is that there's a way in which the left appears to believe that working class people, middle class people, are all kind of temporarily embarrassed social democrats. That, like, Noam Chomsky has pointed to the polling that shows that people, by and large, in Canada and the United States, believe that universal health care is a good thing, you know, and you look at the mismatch between what they believe is a good policy and what's actually done, and you say, well, if you could simply expand the voter base, if you could, like, take the Democratic Party and eliminate its right wing and you could take it over, that there will be a large groundswell of people who are just champion the bit in order to have, you know, social democratic, like a Great Society Part Two or a Green New Deal or whatever the case may be. And I think that, like, the last 10 to 15 years have been really instructive for all of us to disabuse us of that notion. And it's not to say that people don't believe that social goods like that are a positive thing, or that they could be done in a better, more, let's say, common way. It's only to say that they don't trust the politicians and they don't trust the state to actually get these things done. And so I feel like all of us fooled ourselves for a long time. And this is kind of from the 1990s to the 2010s, to think that, like, if you could just be like the progressives, but more left, if you could just be the progressives, but more right. progressive, if yeah. you could actually do what the Democrats, quote unquote, really wanted to do, then you could succeed. But I've been disabused of that. Do you think a lot of people have? Have you been disabused of that?
Oh, I've totally been disabused of that. I was disabused of that already, like after Bernie lost the first time. By 2020, what I was kind of hoping. So 2020 was when I was probably the most communist sympathizer for sure. Like I was at a point where I would like call myself Marxist adjacent. Communism for me was always kind of like Pascal's wager, or it's kind of like it's like a Nirvana thing. It's like, we'll figure that out maybe after socialism, but it's like, I don't know if I'm convinced, but I'm not anti. In 2020, I was hoping that Bernie like could at least come far enough to, if he lost, there would be a mass mobilization that could take it elsewhere. But that's not what I saw happen. What I saw happen is, on the one hand, half of the left, or maybe even more of it, was being like, oh no, you have to line behind Biden no matter what to defeat fascism. And the other half was kind of like spiraling into this nihilism. And I've seen it continue to this day, which is I really thought that maybe social Democrats failing was good because people will get radicalized by something more. But then I really realized how confused that ultra left space actually is and how divided it is. And what I saw coming out of that space was not good. What I saw is a bunch of copium, a bunch of like people stuck in the past, Stalin and Trotsky, cosplaying like Dungeons and Dragons communist edition. It was just embarrassing. But then you have people who are trying to figure things out, who are having important discussions, you know, like we're trying to have. So it's a confused space, but I think we do have to accept that, like, we're in a kind of like pre-political moment when it comes to left politics, in that there's nothing on the horizon. So you kind of have to almost figure out what went wrong. Cause it's like the first step to like fixing problems is like recognizing what they are. And I think the European left has been disabused of those illusions that you're talking about. And we'll get to that. Cause that relates to neo-leftism, but I think the American left is
Yeah. Go on.
Oh, no worries.
The American,
you muted there. I didn't quite catch the first part you said.
What I said, I was quipping that, that you live in Canada, which is basically Europe. So when we're talking about the European left, we're talking about you, but I'm not sure.
Oh, our left sucks worse. This is a hot take actually.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, our left is really bad, actually. Just a quick note on that. So in Canada, the conservatives looked like they were going to win a supermajority under the leadership of probably the most dislikable leader they've ever had. I mean, the guy was literally like forget that Simpsons character. They can like to compare him with the glasses who gets bullied. He's just a dork. He's like Ben Shapiro if he ran. He's just a total dork, unlikable. Looks like he would get shoved in a locker in high school. This guy was about to carry, Pierre Poilievre.
Yeah, that guy sucks. I've seen it before.
He sucks. Pierre Poilievre looked like he was going to bring the conservatives to a supermajority. Now, Donald Trump getting reelected and having that trade war with Canada single-handedly just propelled the liberals out of nowhere, who also just swapped their leadership. They took out Trudeau, who was historically unpopular, and put this guy, Mark Carney, who's kind of like an enlightened technocrat, I guess, a very centrist technocrat.
Who worked for the Bank of England previously?
Yeah, he worked for the Bank of England, Bank of Canada. He's sort of like a globalist who knows what he's doing. And he doesn't like piss people off in the way Trudeau does, because Trudeau is just like so fake. Like there's just something about him people really hate about Trudeau.
He's like Nepo baby, and he's
Nepo
like,
baby, yeah.
Attractive and smooth. He's like smooth faced
people. Yeah. Shit. Yeah. He's Yeah. So like Mark Carney just seems like he's a guy who's not built for politics, who's put in there. That said, the Liberal Party is still not popular. But that, look, what was interesting to me is that this change that was single-handedly brought by Donald Trump, and like Canadians getting so scared, they're like, okay, we need to elect a liberal so that Canada like doesn't become part of the US. And really, like, a lot of boomers fell for this. If you look at the voting demographics, like, boomers just went hard liberal. It's insane. Boomers and Gen X. Young people, it's like a lot of them didn't vote, and a lot actually voted for the Conservative Party, especially young men without college degrees, just like completely just for the Conservative Party. Whereas, yeah, women voted liberal. There's that divide too. That's another thing that's interesting, which I do think is generational, actually. But with the Conservatives, okay, with all this, the NDP lost votes. You would think that with the historically unpopular Liberal Party plus the threat of Trump, the left would come back. The NDP lost votes. They shifted to the Liberals to get out, you know, the Conservatives. And the leftist does not seem to be picking back up at all. And this is the opposite of what people thought. People thought, okay, maybe if Trump gets elected, the left will get resurrected. What's been happening was Trump's failing now. Mm-hmm. You know, don't let, like, people are now excited by Zoran Mamdani. I think that's good. But, like, Zoran Mamdani's New York. What's happening in the broader thing? Well, Charlie Kirk got shot. All the leftists thought he was a fascist and that, oh, well, I guess he had it coming. Or, well, I don't condone violence, but he was hateful. Well, you know who replaced him? Nick Fuentes. I think that's, like, emblematic of a zeitgeist shift, which is that where this was going, the right wing is not... People aren't like shifting to the left. They're shifting farther and farther and farther right. And that's due to a lot of complex reasons. But, you know, and people could boil it down to Israel being why Fuentes got big. I think that's part of it. But it's, if you look at this trend, it's been happening in Europe for a lot, much longer period. In Europe, they've just been going farther right, farther right. And you don't really see, like in Italy, right? They had this right-wing government, I can't even keep track of their parties. They have so many damn elections, but they had this one right-wing government. And when it like collapsed, everyone was like, okay, yay, the far right collapsed. And then Maloney fucking replaced them.
Right. It was Mario Salvini Mario Salvini, I believe.
Yes, Salvini. Yeah, that guy.
He took over for a literal globalist technocrat who was Mario Draghi. Right. Yeah. And then I remember actually talking with Derek Varn about when Maloney got elected, and it was very scary, right, for everybody. Fascism had arrived, and obviously I'm not a supporter of Maloney, but Maloney has been very much domesticated, let's say, by bond markets and by the European Union, I guess economically and geopolitically, if you want to make that distinction between those two things. But I remember, and I'm picking up, I think, and I'm fundamentally agreeing with you that this was a lost opportunity, a missed opportunity for the left. I'm not sure that I believe any longer that it's a question of a problem of leadership. Like if Bernie Sanders and AOC and Zoran had been the leaders of the Democratic Party, or what's that? The nice NDP guy up there, the Sikh gentleman.
Agmeet Singh, yeah. He's about to be replaced. There's currently, at the time we're recording, a leadership race. We don't know who will be the next leader. Right. I'm not enthusiastic about any of them. I hope the Avi Lewis guy wins. They're all not great, but like
would you agree or disagree that it's a question of leadership? Not around the edges, but
no.
It's structural, right? It's,
that's where the left, yeah, we are in agreement on that. Like the left is deluded when they say, okay, like you brought this up actually earlier when you said, you know, the people like to point to these polls. They'll say, well, the left is actually popular on all these issues. If only we just figured shit out and got the right people elected. Now, they're very selective about those issues. They just happen to usually pick like the most obvious issues that like people generally can get behind, like higher wages or like healthcare, cheaper housing. They conveniently always skip over the social issues or even like climate issues, which, you know, climate issues, I do take those to me are actually very serious. I take that's very dear to my heart. but like the reality is like that's totally failed in terms of in a being able to like make people give a shit about that. Like that's totally completely failed. The other social issues that people complain the most about, those are always avoided. And I thought maybe Zoran, at least like he didn't talk about it because he didn't have to. Like that was a sort of benefit because that's how they get you. But I think they would have got him on a national level. They would have asked him a question that, you know, sounds like as a culture war distraction, but it gets at the heart of the contradictions of the liberal left. You know, like they'll ask him like whether, you know, what he thinks about borders. What does he think about, you know, gender? How many genders are there? What does he think about this? And that's where actually like the left totally falls apart because it immediately reveals itself to be like completely out of touch with most people.
Yeah.
On like very common sense matters, you know, and the left thinks it's like either you support everything or you like hate minorities, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is where, thankfully, you know, and I need people like you to remind me of this sometimes. Thankfully, I live in my own bubble. You know, of course, I was ground zero on the Zoran thing because I'm a New Yorker. And this is my town. And having that race become a national phenomenon, it's always kind of national here in New York, but like this was really national. Really, I think, put into contrast for me and, you know, people when I hang out with leftists here in New York, they tend to be labor oriented, you know, like they come from the labor movement or they're people who are like, let's say, more IWW and more DSA labor than like, say, I don't know. I'm trying to think of like a more political type organization like Working Families Party, you know, which is like one of our fusion type groups. So it's helpful, I think, to hear from you these things and to be reminded of what things look like more broadly. And I think that maybe part of why I invited you on is I sensed that you were a history guy and history and structures help to disabuse you of these notions. Where I stand on all this stuff is like, I think, pretty unsatisfying, maybe for you, maybe for a lot of people, but it's been very salutary for me over the last several years or so, which is to recognize that we are at the end of a historical process, right? That some, well, you can call it the Popular Front, you could call it progressivism, you can call it the New Deal order, you can call it the Global New Deal, you can call it the post-war order, you can call it like the mixed economy or managed capitalism, a lot of things you can call it. But one thing that we can call it is dying. It's not dead yet, but there is like a configuration of the relationship between the capitalist state and capital itself, a kind of unipolar moment, a kind of end of history, let's call it, that is passing away before our eyes. And we're moving into a new phase. And I think that to tie to things to what you were saying earlier about the left and its failure to pick things up is I think that the left, as we understand, as we grew up with, as we know it, being a sort of like the left wing of the Democratic Party or like a global Democratic Party, if you're in Canada or Europe or elsewhere, I think that that is not just like its leadership is unable to rise to the occasion, but like actually the end of this, like where capital accumulation has brought us, where globalization and its backlash has brought us, where the multipolar moment, if you want to call that, has brought us, is a phase shift that like scrambles all of the different quadrants that we understood politics to be on. Of course, the greatest example of this is Donald Trump himself, who is and trust me, I know this, he's an Ed Koch Democrat. He's a New York City 1970s, 1980s Democrat.
It's true.
Right-wing Democrat. And he is now in control, of course, of the Republican Party, and his successors will try to capture that lightning in a bottle again. So what I guess maybe why this is unsatisfying is that I don't claim to, and I don't think that you either claim to have a way out of this for the left, a political way out of this, where I think that you and I both agree, and maybe this is part of our structural thinking, is that this is a pre-political moment, that this is like 1847, let's say, right? That everyone kind of knows that there's massive changes coming and they're coming down the pipe, but there's a lot of incoherence and misunderstanding of things, because as we move into this new epoch, we're going to have to respond in ways that we haven't maybe since the 19th century, maybe since the early 20th century. So what are your thoughts on that, Tony? That was a lot.
I want to ask you, though, it's like, what was that like being in New York? Because I have a couple of friends in New York, and one of them is like newly politicized, actually a liberal friend of mine who kind of is indifferent to politics and wouldn't usually like to talk about politics. He really likes Zoran Mamdani, and out of nowhere sent me like this communist newspaper he saw on the street. And I'm like, oh no, that's a Trotskyist org. But so it's like, and Catherine Liu I talked to recently, she's very cynical about the left, but she was kind of excited. Like, what was that like? Because from what Varen told me, I don't have a clear idea of what your past views are, but just the sense from the couple episodes I've listened to of Antifada and from what he's told me, it's like, I feel like you used to be kind of like ultra left and the kind of are in this, like, he used funny terms. He said post-left socialist Republican or something like that. And I'm like, that sounds oddly kind of close to me, except, you know, no one willingly takes the word post-left. I'm sure you don't willingly take it. I don't. It's kind of like an ironic title, but the Republican got me interested.
Yeah, no, I saw your episode with Daniel Tutt, where you guys were going back and forth about it. So I know that you're familiar with, I think the growing literature, which is trying to bring Marxism, not to create a new Marxism, but to do to excavate the sort of history of Marx's relationship, political relationship to republicanism. Post-left is a very interesting moniker, because as Varen will tell you, because Varen and I are the same age, used to mean something completely different. Used to be an anarchist thing.
Anarchism. Ted Kaczynski too was like, you know, kind of associated with that,
right? Yeah. So I'll take that. I wouldn't say I was an ultra. I would say I was a communizer of sorts, but a very confused one, because communization,
really?
Yeah.
That is kind of ultra.
It is ultra. And the way that it was weird and contradictory for me is that it helped to explain things. I don't want to sound like the old guy, but more and more these days I sound like the fucking old guy. I sound like the old guy at the job. I give the apprentices, oh, you don't want to stay with one company for your whole apprenticeship. You want to have like a broad. I don't want to sound like the old guy, but I'm going to be the old guy because I kind of am the old guy and I have to accept that. But like 2008, that crisis right there opened up a whole world. It opened up a whole world of possibilities that if you grew up as I did in what's now widely regarded as like a golden age, somehow it didn't feel that way at the time in the 1990s, in that end of history where, you know, the rising tide was lifting all boats, globalization, Bill Clinton, even into like the George W. Bush era, there was the sense that like the economic question was solved, when 2007, 2008 comes, it is a huge shock. But very similar, I think, to your encountering the Bernie Sanders movement in 2016, this was a moment that jogged all sorts of possibilities for me. What was confusing about my communization thing is that I learned a lot about history of the class movement. I had friends who were in EndNotes and groups like this. And it was very helpful for me to kind of have a critical take on the broader sort of history, the balance sheet of the 20th century, as they call it. But there was like especially theory communists who had a very like anti-workerist sort of idea and ideology, and yet I remained a worker, and I've kind of always been a workerist at the same time. So very bizarre to kind of live in that interstitial space. But you know, it was for me the experience of the last really 5 to 10 years that disabused me of those notions of the communization stuff. I would have told you 10 years ago that Marx's political theory, like his mature political theory, going from the manifesto all the way through the civil wars in France, you know, all the way up to the end of his life, and Engels also, that there was a way in which we had passed through, I would maybe call it decadence theory or something like that. We'd passed through the moment in time where that political theory, social republicanism, you can call it, was relevant, that it was no longer relevant in the 21st century. And I think that I have been forced to, I think, due to like the many, many failures that you and I have already itemized here, forced to re-encounter that theory, or to encounter for the first time, kind of mature, like a rereading of Marx that ties, I think, very tantalizingly ties the 19th century struggle for not just socialism, but proletarian socialism, to the sort of bourgeois revolutions and bourgeois freedoms that were instantiated here in the New World, and echoed back and forth across the Atlantic, echoed obviously to places like Haiti, and then later on to the Far East. And that's kind of the realm that I'm in right now. You know, that's the kind of world that I'm working in. And it's not abstract for me, you know, because really at the end of the day, when you ask what things were like on the ground in New York City with the Zoran phenomenon, you know, like I say this to Varn all the time, and maybe what separates me from a lot of people on the left, or the post-left as the case may be, is that I mostly am with Republicans day in and day out, and like the banter and the talks, and to the extent that there's political talk and a lot of
in most New York. People,
political, absolutely, there's like you talked about it with Varn, like that working class conservatism, you know, in the building trades here in New York. Our union is like most others in the United States. The rank and file is largely like conservative, and the leadership, of course, for historical and political reasons, is endorsing people like Andrew Cuomo or you know, other dubious people. So that is something that tempered the sort of the madness of the Zoran thing, is that, you know, I would be reading the national news and it'd be telling me about this great upsurge. And sure, I would see people like in Park Slope or whatever, you know, nicer parts of the borough wearing their Zoran gear or whatever. And they would try to get me to sign up for lists or whatever. But by and large, the phenomenon for me was more like people like, oh, you got long hair, are you voting for the commie or whatever? And me like kind of laughing and shrugging that whole thing off, but trying to like have enough of a an outside perspective on the whole thing, try to be analytic about something that's happening in real time, in person. And so, you know, I registered as a Democrat for the first time in my life. The first time I ever voted, it was for Ralph Nader in the year 2000 for the presidential election. So I can put that notch on my belt there. I voted for him in the primary against Andrew Cuomo, who my union endorsed. I even went to a Cuomo rally that I've told you. Show before. So I'm not the best representative, but maybe I'm an interesting representative of what the Zoran phenomenon was like.
What do you think of Curtis Sliwa? I have to say I wish the left had its Curtis Sliwa. Like, I wish you had Curtis Sliwa with some socialist policies. When I saw him on the Breakfast Club talking about how he was influenced by the Black Panthers, I'm like, God, only he like supported, you know, some socialist policies. What's so good? Because then some people say, "Oh, I hate his crime policy." It's like, I don't know. You know, if you looked at what a lot of leftists historically thought about crime, it's
not there's like a new left hangover on crime, and there's a hangover from the 1960s, 70s, and 80s hangover in our ideology when it comes to crime. I would not say that I've evolved on that thing at all. Like, I still think that like the carceral state is obviously a danger. I think of it now.
I think prisons need to be reformed.
Yeah,
like I'm not anti-cop. That's what I mean. So it's like there's a lot of left anti-cop. I'm not anti-cop, but I'm pro prison reform, not prison abolition. But like, you know, I think we just need less prison like shorter sentences, more humane conditions, more rehabilitation lists. But like the anti-cop stuff, I just never I never got with it. And I actually know somebody who like suffered serious police brutality. He actually was not a black person, but you know, suffered serious police brutality. He didn't end up anti-cop either. Like from what I saw, the anti-cop people were people who never had to deal with police ever. Like just people I've seen anyway.
Some of the most anti-cop people I know are very conservative also, and it's because they're fucking felons, you know. They're fucking drunk drivers, they're fucking wife beaters or whatever. And so their experience with cops is like getting arrested and locked up or whatever. Others' experience with cops are essentially strike breakers, you know. And so
yeah, that makes sense. That's definitely that makes more sense.
The question in the abstract, again, I feel like gets us into territory where you and I as individuals with like considered opinions on these things can agree or disagree on the cop. The question of Curtis Silva is a practical political question. And I don't want to steal my own thunder here because I allegedly I'm going to be on a Platypus panel still in December whenever they set it up. We got censored before the election by Columbia University, those bastards. But one of the things I'm going to say, what I was going to say and am going to say about Curtis Silva is like on the question of republicanism, on the question of like governance, on the question of what sort of society, what sort of economy and society would we imagine is ideal and what should the proletariat fight for in terms of its liberties and its freedoms. Curtis Silva had a very fascinating clip, and you may have seen it even. It was making the rounds on the Everything app recently, where he was on, I believe it was the Morton Downey Jr. show. And this was so long ago that Morton Downey Jr., who I forgot his name, is smoking a cigarette in like this talk show. And he's like, Curtis, you know, talk to the other guests that I have here. And the other guests are appear to be Orthodox or Hasidic rabbis. And I'm not even sure what the context, it'd be fascinating to watch the entire thing, but this is maybe the 1980s, you know? And Curtis is like, you rabbis are up on stage and you're like talking about the Arabs and you're talking about the Palestinians and all this shit. He's like, I got a group. It's called the Guardian Angels, all right? I got a Palestinian and I got a Jew, right? They're both in the organization together. Do they fight about politics? They fight about it all the time. They fight about the Middle East or whatever. But when they're in the group, when they're in the Guardian Angels, they squash it and they come together because we have a common purpose. And I would watch this and people would make fun of it and people thought it was like just funny, you know, to see this guy going off on Israel Palestine, like, wow, he's got great. But actually his views there are consistent, I think, with Guardian Angels being like a civil social organization that was picking up for what the city could not do in the 1970s, which is deal with violent crime, especially on the subways.
Which was absolutely real, contrary to what some leftists like to act.
And it was, and leftists can act however the fuck they want. But that was the fruits of deindustrialization, of us losing a million industrial jobs. This is a history that my parents lived through. It's a history. If you go to the bar up the street from me, you know, you'll hear people talk about there used to be up the street a lot of fucking jobs and all the fucking jobs went away. And a lot of tax base used to be here. And a lot of the tax base went to New Jersey or Long Island. Right. These are real issues. Right. Mm-hmm. In that climb of that era, you can deny that it existed, but it did exist. Mm-hmm. And it existed because of capitalism. It existed because of like the failure of our social municipality.
There's a way like leftists use that, right? They sometimes say, yeah, it's caused by capitalism, therefore we shouldn't deal with it until we abolish capitalism.
Right.
I always find it's like that is so unconvincing to like most normal people who know that you're not going to overthrow capitalism. Like that's just, you're not going to like, that's not how it's going to happen. So you're just going to say like, oh, we're just going to postpone dealing with problems because it's caused
by... Tony, you have to understand that the point is not to deal with the problems. The point is to have some eschaton, you know, where like the fucking veil's going to fall down and whatever. To finish my, because you asked me directly about Curtis, to finish on that, I will say that, like, I did not vote for him. And I would not vote for him because while he has like a, I will say a small R, but also a big R Republican conception of how change happens, how civil society operates, the distinction between these things and what it looks like for working class people like himself and others to come together on a project and be able to fight and struggle for something, and what practical unity looks like within a civil social organization, very inspiring. But his problem is the big R part of that. The problem is that he remains within the realm of capitalist politics. He remains seeing the guardian angels not as like a militia that could be built up to the point where it makes a municipal police unnecessary any longer, because the working class itself would grow to the point where it would be able to overcome the need for that. He instead sees it as like a tool to make up for like the failure of capitalist politicians. But if they just did the right thing, you know, he wouldn't have to do that sort of thing. So his conception of politics is, I think, in a weird way, like closer to how we might imagine an actual socialist party, not a DSA candidate who is not under discipline of the working class of New York City, no matter what the DSA might profess about itself, is not under democratic, he's not under democratic rule by the working class of the city. You know, in the meantime, you're left with a basket of policies, and ones that are popular for immigrants, working class, large swaths of working class people, but also people who make $130,000 a year in this city who can't afford childcare. You know, and so there you have a winning coalition. But to finish on this point, and then maybe you and I should go to the bonus, because also my oven is yelling at me right now because I have to take my dinner out of it. You know, it's back to this question of, is what's happening in New York City in 2025 a adequate template for left politics across the country, in Canada, in Europe, and across the world? And I think you and I are both dubious about that. No,
I mean, of course, very dubious about it. But I should clarify a couple of things, is because, you know, if we're running up on time on the public and I'm going to go to the bonus, I feel like I gave a horrible impression about what my views are, just because we didn't really quite do introduction. So because I mentioned the thing about the cop, I do think cops are over militarized in the sense of, like, you know, there's like stormtroopers. I mean, they're already more militarized in America than they are in Canada, much less Japan, where, you know, a lot of them don't even have guns. It's more like, you know what I mean, the anti-cop mentality of like all cops are bad, like that. Like BLM protests, I would have this dialectical relationship with my friend who like never went to college, and we'd always talk politics because he was into politics, but he would be like one of these guys who really likes Bernie, but then he'd watch Tim Pool and like be freaking out about trans. Like, you know what I mean? Like, he'd be kind of all over the place. Like a lot of people who aren't like super ideologically captured, they just kind of go with their common sense. I would always be in this position where he'd be like, yeah, I like what you're saying, but I don't see that on the left. And then I would like defend parts of the left. I would like defend this and defend that. With BLM, I remember he was like, yeah, I don't fuck with this. And I'm like, you know, yeah, me neither, honestly. Like, but in the sense, it's like, I get with the cause, but a lot of these people are just like, you know, during COVID, just, they just want an excuse to break shit. Like, let's be honest, it's not all about social justice for these people. And what is that going to lead to? What, you know,
it gets to the nihilism that you and Varn were talking about.
Yeah, so
the
nihilism. Yeah. But it's like, when I say it's just the anti, like being all cops are bad, it's just a very anti-systemic position to have. It's like, you know, in Marx, nowhere does he say bourgeois people are evil, right? And I would say like bourgeois people, you know, have way more power than a cop does. It's like, sure, cops can abuse their power in the moment, and there are people who are shitty people who are cops. But it's like this idea, some people use like a pseudo communist justification for this, where they'll say cops, the only purpose of cops is that they defend private property, you know, and citing like the origin of police and skipping to today, as if that makes any sense, to be like, yeah, cops is really real purpose of defending private property. If we abolish capital, we wouldn't have cops. It's this, you know, you get like some lunatic thinking, and then that's the thing. And they're like, oh, anyone who signs up to do that, to like protect private property, they're like an enemy. And it's just, it's all really ridiculous, you know.
Well, Tony, you don't have to be scared. I don't think that you're going to get a lot of hate mail from this episode. And I feel like I'm just an old leftist.
I would say I'm like an old leftist.
What we're going to do is I'm going to caution everybody out there that they should subscribe. Where can they subscribe to your podcast? I'm sorry.
One Dime Radio, I would recommend on YouTube or Spotify or Apple, wherever you listen to podcasts. One Dime Radio is a podcast. I've had Derek Varn. I've had Benjamin Studebaker. I've had Catherine Liu. A lot of guests you might be familiar with here. And I have the main channel, which is one just called One Dime. You know, originally started as like, I'm, you know, your boss makes a dollar.
Ah, yes.
Yeah.
It's a shitting reference. Got it.
Yeah. Then I try to make it like be ambiguous, but let's not get into that. But with that, yeah, that video, I have a lot of stuff on modern monetary theory, economics. Of one, it's an introduction to all the fucking Marxist ideologies. There's that. So my next one's going to be on how China works and why the U.S. didn't always support Israel.
Nice. Folks, you're going to want to sign up to check that out. We're going to take this behind the paywall because, I think that we've put our finger on things in this free half that I've been thinking about for a long time, but I haven't really talked about it on the pod. So behind the paywall, we're not going to be lauding the police. We're not going to say cops rule, proletarians drool. We're going to actually fucking hash it out and I think talk broadly about continuing to talk about the limitations of the left and what politics looks like at this moment. So Tony, thanks for coming on the main episode. If you want to become a patron of our pod and listen to this, it is patreon.com. Let's see if I can remember my new podcast name since we got rid of the old one because I had Antifa in it a little bit too hot.
Wreckage.
This Wreckage, patreon.com.
It's on the screen, man.
Yeah, I know. I have to keep referencing it because like sometimes I forget that these are the times that we're in right now, that like finally we changed the name of our podcast because we don't want DHS showing up at our doors. That's just where we're at. We're going to hash it out on the back half. Thank you, Tony, for coming to hang out.
Thank you for having me. Become a patron and hear us talk about the difference between the old left, the new left, and neo-leftism.
A real professional. He knows how to kick it to the paywall. All right, Tony, cool. I feel like we're on a roll here. I feel like another half hour or 45 minutes in us. So why don't I stop this oven from yelling at me and then we'll start again.
Sounds good.
I was standing on East Cairo's feet one day. I was standing on East Cairo's feet one day. Standing on East Cairo's feet one day. One dime was all I had.